Galen Bradford is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Bradford by injecting him with massive doses of drugs normally used to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Bradford's attorneys say he is mentally retarded and that his execution is illegal. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubick, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special interview guest Human Hadayati, Texas organizer for Witness to Innocence. The Execution Watch begin.
And that wonderful voice was Larry Douglas, who did the intro to today's show. He is going to be joining the other two lawyers in the room, Jim Skelton and Susan Ashley, when it is time to do that part of the thing. I'm Ray Hill, and you're listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFT Houston on HD, KPFT HD1 channel, and via the internet over KPFT.org, and of course www.executionwatch.org. Listen up, and after today's show there will be an archive of this show added to the extensive archive at executionwatch.org. Galen Bradford is 42 years old, and he came within 6 days of being executed in October when the United States Supreme Court issued a stay. So this is not our first time to visit this case. It's just the first time we visited about it on the radio. We prepared for his last scheduled execution, which received a last-minute stay, which gives me occasion to draw to your attention out there in the listening audience that this Execution Watch is not a weekly show. It's not a monthly show. We wished we didn't have a show, but every time Texas kills someone, we go on the air for the hour during which that happens. At the end of this hour, unless something extraordinary happens, Galen Bradford will be dead. He will be killed by lethal injection on an execution order signed by the governor of the state of Texas. That will happen in Huntsville, where we have Gloria Rubick. So I think I'll bring Gloria in. Gloria, are you there?
Ray?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Well, the 468th execution is proceeding. The media walked in about 3 minutes ago, and Galen's friend and spiritual advisor, accompanied by prison officials, just walked into the Walls unit.
So there is one witness for Galen?
One friend and one spiritual advisor.
Okay, two. Two for Galen.
Yeah. His family got back to Dallas last night and are preparing the funeral arrangements, but they couldn't be here. It was too much for them.
Okay, Gloria, would you explain to our listening audience the significance of crossing the road and entering the Walls unit? What is that?
Well, we're standing out here on the corner of, where are we, 12th Street and Avenue I, where the Walls unit is located. Right across the street from that is the prison's administration building. The news media has a press office in there, and they're allowed five different media outlets to witness an execution. I saw, I think, four go in, including Michael Grashik with the Associated Press, and I don't know who the others were. I'm assuming some people from Dallas, but and the Huntsville item. But anyway, the media, when they walk, the media walks from the administration building across 12th Street into the prison. We know that there are no appeals, no pardons, no nothing. Execution's going to happen. And then a few minutes after the media walks in, we wait for the family and friends and loved ones of the person being executed to cross the street, and that's what just happened.
Now, if there are witnesses for the victim of the case or victims of the case, they do not come in that way.
No, I don't know where they go in, but we never, ever, ever see them. I'm told that they enter from a different side of the prison, and they're not visible. They have the street blocked off, so, I mean, it's not like we can see all the doors. I don't even know where the doors are besides this main
one. Well, there, I mean, it's a prison. There's a front door and a back door.
Okay, then I guess.
And the back door is on the other end of the unit. It is exactly at the end of that block that intersects with 12th Street there.
Oh, okay. Well, we never see them, so I don't know if there's any victims' families or not.
Yeah, Gloria, I know the geography is to live there.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've been back through there, and I know that actually when you go into the prison to witness, you leave the building and walk down a little sidewalk and enter something else.
Yeah, well, those outbuildings are where they keep their clothing supplies and things of that people being released. But at any rate, are there other demonstrators? Are you alone?
Oh, no, there's there's only six of us here tonight. There's another woman from Switzerland who was out here who's, I don't know where she disappeared to. I think she's pretty distraught. She's visited Galen for 15 years.
Mercy.
And he told her he didn't want her to go in, and she said she was actually relieved.
Okay, Gloria, I am going to move on.
Okay.
And if anything happens, you get in touch with Elizabeth via normal means.
Okay. You know, I just want to say one thing about Galen Bradford. When I was reading about him, Ray, you know, the people that wind up on death row are not the people who have had the best of circumstances and the best of luck and breaks in this society. And I read about a guy who started drinking 4, 5, 6 beers a day when he was 12 years old. I don't know where his parents were. He dropped out of school in 8th grade. He was arrested at 17 for burglary. And in fact, that's when he was tested by TDC themselves and found to have an IQ below 70, which should mean that he is mentally retarded and shouldn't be executed. But, you know, he wasn't your average high school graduate or college student type person. And I think that's just, today's execution really typifies who gets in trouble in this country and who gets put into the justice system and who's executed.
And Gloria is the founder of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and they can be contacted via the internet at abolitionmovement.org, abolitionmovement.org. Thank you, Gloria. We'll talk to you later in the show.
Okay, bye-bye.
And Dave, are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
Where is here?
We're at the corner of Shepherd and Westheimer out in front of St. Anne's Catholic Church.
Okay.
And this is where we'll be having all our vigils this month. And I heard Gloria say they had about 6 people up there. That's how many we have here.
Okay.
And not a big group. I think the last time we were out here, we had about 15. But Galen's case, is, you know, his case is not that well known or hasn't received that much attention. I know, by the way, I overheard Gloria talk about the lady from Switzerland. That's her name's Brigitte Nickenberg, and she has been visiting Galen, I think, for something like 15 years. And she now lives in Norway. And, yeah, she's distraught, but there is a young fellow, a musician, and I think he plays in the symphony or the opera, who also knows Galen, who went in for the execution vigil today inside.
Oh, okay. He is the visitor in addition to the spiritual.
Right. Just a young guy. I don't think he's ever witnessed an execution before. And it's kind of tough situation for them, definitely.
Have you ever witnessed an execution?
I've witnessed 3, actually. Dominique Green, James Allridge, and another fellow that I witnessed.
And that leaves a lasting impression on you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough thing. The first time, particularly, I mean, to see a human being killed right before your eyes. Somebody, particularly, I knew Dominique and James real well, and they were both, in my opinion, they were both rehabilitated people. I don't think they would have hurt a fly if they'd come out of prison. But that didn't make any difference to the state, of course, because rehabilitation is not taken into consideration when that date comes around.
Dave, our regards to the other vigilants, and Dave Atwood is the founder. We're doing Founders Day, and he's current
Founders Day
and a current board member of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and is the author of a memoir, Detour to Death Row. And you can get in touch with that organization via the internet at www.tcadp.org.
Absolutely right. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. Have a good
bye-bye.
Day. Bye-bye.
And that was, let me figure out how to do this. You get out of the studio and you forget. How shocking. I have Jim Skelton in here with me, and we have Larry, whose voice you've already heard, and we have Susan. Somebody want to start telling me about this case?
Well, I guess I'd better do it. One thing I want to mention, I know there's been some criticism about the fact that this guy had an IQ of 68, but truthfully, one IQ test at TDC does not qualify somebody as being mentally retarded. Never has been, never will be. The problem with this case is real simple. This guy was in trouble in grade school. He was in trouble in high school. He was in trouble on the streets. When they put him in jail, he was in trouble there. Everywhere he went, he created trouble. And this is in 20 short years, because during the time he was in school, they had a number of police officers who testified at the trial that he was always starting trouble and was in cooperatives out late at night running the streets. And I never could find much about his background. I don't know if he was abused as a child. There was no evidence of any type of decision about getting mitigating punishment. And here's the tragic thing about this case. He first started off, as soon as he became an adult, he burglarized a high school, was placed on probation, and while he was on probation, he didn't do well while on probation. And to make sure he didn't do well on probation, he committed an armed robbery. So he gets sent to the joint on a robbery case and a burglary case. He comes out of prison on parole, and this really kind of surprised me. Apparently the parole officer liked him, and the parole officer, out of his own pocket, got money to send him to a vocational school. Wouldn't go, didn't go, and wouldn't complete it. He got out of parole less than a year. And he told his girlfriend, a girlfriend of his, he's going to make some money, left the apartment with two guys. And he and a guy by the name of Vandran Seymour go into a grocery store in MLK in Dallas. And there is a security guard, a 29-year-old security guard who'd been working just 2 days. He had his back to Bradford when Bradford walked in the store. Wasn't doing anything, didn't bother anybody. Bradford shot him point blank in the back. They shot him in the back. The guy fell to the floor, raised his hands, began to beg for his life, beg him not to shoot him any further. And while he's on the floor, he shot him like 3 or 4 more times. The security guard lived about an hour. What made this particularly hard from a legal viewpoint, all of this is recorded on a videotape. And the store video recorded the shooting in the back, recorded the security guard laying on the floor, begging for his life, and Bradford shooting him 3 or 4 more times while he's laying on the floor with his hands up in the air. And what happened when the jury heard this tape and viewed the tape, in fact, as a matter of fact, he had two trials. One jury convicted him, and then is reversed because the trial judge up there didn't let any evidence in about some some psychological evidence he kept out. Court of Criminal Appeals reversed it. A second juror convicted him, took him less than 30 minutes to convict him because, number one, they had it on video, for one thing. And when they were playing the video, according to the lawyers involved in the case, it's so graphic that many members of the jury were crying during the videotape when they saw this man wandering on the floor begging for his life and getting shot repeatedly. And the only thing that Bradford got from this robbery was $7, a pipe, and a baseball cap. That was it. And he took a man's life for that. And he was arrested.
He actually got $7 out of the
billfold. He took the billfold. He never took any money out of the store. He got $7 from the wallet of the man he shot. And then he was arrested. When he was arrested, he gave a written confession. So there's no doubt that there's no defense from a lawyer viewpoint. There's nothing you can do when they do it on video. And when they play the video, the jury's crying in sympathy for the victim. And then on top of that, he has a written confession. Then at the punishment hearing, they call a series of policemen who testified they had known him from his street name, known him for years, and every one of those, or several series of policemen, said he had this reputation for being a bad person. A series of women came forward to testify about the times he tried to assault them. And then, of course, he had the typical psychologist coming in saying he's a sociopath and he's going to commit crimes in the future. Because, again, when he was in prison on his initial go-around, he was involved in two race riots. He had a lot of trouble with the inmates, so he had trouble everywhere he went. And so that wasn't too hard for the jury to come to the conclusion in this particular case that he should be executed. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the mental retardation part. As you know, we had a case called Atkins, A-T-K-I-N-S, that said it's a violation of the Sixth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment to execute retarded people. But the problem is they didn't give the definition of mental retardation. They let each state decide what was mentally retarded. Mm-hmm. So what happened, we had a case that came out of Texas called Ex parte Brasino, and it defined, and it took the position that mental retardation, and they adopted, as a matter of fact, let me see if I can find it in my notes, they adopted a deal out of the American Association of Mental Retardation, defined mental retardation. What it basically means is that, and here's what the six factors are. You got to have a significant below average IQ of 70 or below. So you got, and he scored 68 on one IQ test of T's in a prison test. Number two, it's got to be accompanied by related unadaptive problems. And what I mean by that, this means you haven't got the functioning skill to dress yourself, to flip hamburgers or Whataburger. You can't do these things.
Can't go catch a buzz.
That's right. Well, and the problem is, according to the police officers who had run and countered him, and they would be running around, he'd be running around the guys late at night, and he was kind of the leader of the pack. So he didn't have, though, he apparently obviously had some adaptive skills, and apparently had some ability to impress some people, because a parole officer out of his own pocket pays for a school for him to go to, but he doesn't go to that. And then the next thing, all of this behavior must be exhibited before the age of 18. So what that means is you got to have IQ tests coming from grade school, from high school. It's not something you can fake when you get to TDC. And one of the problems, I was telling Larry Douglas about the IQ test, people who live on the streets or are street people don't do well in IQ tests because they're not written by street people. They're written by psychologists. And a lot of the terminology they don't understand and don't. Now, if the street people wrote the IQ test, they'd be the geniuses and the psychologists, they'd be the idiots. Okay. So that's one of the reasons they don't score
that,
well.
The following editorial position was taken by at least one of the three lawyers at the table. Jim, Larry, Susan, do y'all know any street people? Do you know anybody that runs the streets?
I've met a bunch of them.
I mean, and other than in your professional career, you meet them after you they pick them up out of the
No. I've known. I've known.
I know some lawyers that roam the street.
Well, no. Susan and I both know a guy named Don Seals that was pretty much a street person, and then I knew a whole bunch of people other than that. A whole bunch of people that I've known for years through the years. That have been street people.
Well, let's clarify the difference between street people and a person who likes to run the streets. I think that's two different things.
Okay.
I mean, a street person.
You want to do that?
Okay. There may be a street person, as in somebody who's homeless, mm-hmm. shall we say, is jobless, phoneless, penniless, yep. and homeless. That would qualify as a street person.
Okay.
And then some people might
run
the streets like. People who like to run around the clubs and hang out.
Outside, because they probably don't have any money to go inside.
No, there's people who run the streets that do have money, and they like to go to the clubs and hang out late at night and stay out all night. And
I actually know some of those people.
Yeah.
You think they'd do well in an IQ test?
No, I don't think they would do well in an IQ test, but of course, I've taken an IQ test in prison before, and it's very difficult to take an IQ test if you've got a guard screaming at you at the top of his voice. And I mean, IQ tests need to be given relatively quiet, environments, and there's no such thing as a quiet
one
apartment.
One thing I want to interrupt. Larry had an interesting comment about this case illustrated due process by our court system. We get a lot of criticism, and we have everybody always belly aching and moaning about the court system, but I want Larry to, and he talked earlier about your idea of due process, how this case illustrates due process by our court system. Would you comment on that, Larry?
Yeah, what I was saying is that this case suggested we as a country need to be at least somewhat proud in the fact that there are places where if a person is accused of something like this, there would almost be a street mob wanting to go out and get him. Whereas he was given fairly good due process.
He had two jury trials.
And then the appellate process through the state system and all the way through the federal system. And the videotape showing him and killing Brian Williams, that just angers some people. And I've seen lawyers who get angry, defense lawyers, saying things like, you know, certain cases just cry out for public execution.
I'll tell you about something, Larry. Years ago, a lawyer named Wes Hawker was defending a case. When they showed the photographs of the thing, he started throwing up. He ran to the courtroom. That's the own defense lawyer. That's a hard thing to deal when your own lawyer starts throwing up.
Well, do you think that there might have been IQ evidence from earlier school experience that some lawyer didn't ferret out?
The only thing, and it's hard to find a lot of this because a lot of the opinions weren't published, there was some innuendos that his writ lawyer, you have two writ lawyers, one that files a state writ and one who files a federal writ.
Yeah.
And I think this must have been the lawyer that filed the federal writ. There was an innuendo that he dropped the ball on some timetables to get some things in, and they said ineffective assistance to counsel will not cure that on appellate counsel. So I have, apparently there was some indication, and I never could find an opinion from either federal courts or the state courts that discussed what the complaints were, because they were arguing about ineffective assistance of counsel. But I don't know how you could be effective in with facts like this, and you got your client killing somebody on video and a confession. What do you do with that? But nonetheless, apparently there was somebody dropping the ball, apparently, in the federal writ, and that's why they went back in. What had happened? When this case first went up, it was reversed. Mm-hmm. When it went up the second time, Atkins hadn't been decided. Mm-hmm. So after Atkins came out, that was the basis of the post-conviction writs in federal court. And there was some implication from the different articles I read that the lawyer that handled that dropped the ball in some timetables, and I'm assuming he didn't develop the mental retardation problem well. And that's all I know, and I can't give any more than that.
What was the stay in October about?
Mental retardation.
Okay. Atkins had already been decided.
Yeah, but they went up on a writ on that.
They went up on a writ on that, and it got a stay.
Right.
So that was looked at. Was there any trial court action subsequent to that? Or?
What happened, and again, I don't know what happened. It had to start in the federal district court in Dallas. As you know, you do the state writ, and after the state writ's over, you go into federal court, and you go into the federal district where the murder occurred. So it had to be some court action by the court in Dallas. Well, I pulled the Fifth Circuit opinion, because what the Dallas court did, they denied his Atkins claim on mental retardation.
Okay.
That was one of the things they made in federal court.
And that was appealed.
That was appealed. And the Fifth Circuit wrote like a half a page opinion and simply said that's when they alluded to the fact that in a lawyer being ineffective does not cure the problems of not meeting deadlines under the federal writ requirements. Mm. And that they never said what the lawyer did or didn't do in that opinion. So I'm assuming it had to deal with mental retardation, because that was the only issue they were arguing about in the district court in Dallas. It had to be. And apparently he didn't meet some timetable requirements. Apparently he's an inexperienced lawyer handling the federal writ.
And that happens rarely?
In federal court, it happens pretty rarely, because they don't usually get some knucklehead in federal court to handle one of these 2254
writs. How was that lawyer chosen?
I have no idea. I imagine
the district court?
Probably appointed by the district court. Now, what they've done to cure a lot of that, and they've done some real good work, They now have a federal public defender system that really is very efficient. I mean, very, very, very good. In fact, a guy named Richard Anderson's the head of the federal public defender in Dallas, and I've known Richard for years. Very, very capable lawyer. And I've read some of the stuff he's done on post-conviction writs have been excellent. And I'm assuming it could not have been one of Richard's people. It had to be some guy they appointed, because occasionally they'll appoint lawyers away from the federal public defender system. But it never said exactly what he did or didn't do. They never said that in the opinion of the Fifth Circuit.
Any other comments from...
Well, I guess clearly that raises some due process concerns, though. And we are talking about a death penalty case, so that does cause me some concerns. I know we've got a good system. It's not a perfect system, but that does cause me some concerns.
But see, the real problem, Larry, it's going to be real difficult to prove those three factors in Brasino.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to have to prove an IQ below 70, and it's going to be not one test, but it's got to be ongoings before the age of 18, which means a series of achievement tests in school if you've got those records, if you've got them.
Exactly.
And then you got to have that he can't make a living, can't catch a bus, like Ray said earlier. And then it's got to happen, you know, and it's real difficult to prove that. Those are real hard things to reconstruct.
True.
Well, the thing that gets me is that, yeah, we there's no question about guilt or innocence. That's already established. It's on videotape. It's for sure. But at some point, some group of people decided that the indications here of a low IQ, below retarded...
70's got to be below 70.
Below 70. Even in prison... I know, and I tell you unabashedly that I took an IQ test in diagnostic in 1970.
You think you scored as well as you could have been in the free world?
Of course, because I had given the Stanford-Binet test to college students while I was teaching on fellowship.
What was the difference in two scores? Was any difference?
Not for me, because it was a rote action. I wasn't bothered. But everybody around me was very nervous and very uncomfortable. I know you don't create that atmosphere to give IQ tests.
So you think they did poorly on the Prison Act?
I think most of the people did remarkably poorly, significantly more lower score than they would have if they were given the test under normal college atmosphere circumstances.
Because, see, the only IQ test they had that I could read in the opinions was the IQ test on his first trip to TDC.
Yeah,
so it wasn't one that you would have in the free world.
And that would have been somewhere around the time, the first trip to TDC. We don't know when that is.
Well, he went to TDC. He was only out. He got a two-year sentence. He went to TDC around 17 or 18. He was only 20 when he committed the crime.
Yeah.
So he had to be about 17 or 18.
Yeah, I think so, about 17.
About 17. Yeah.
17, 18. Yeah. So the deal is... and when did the crime happen?
The crime happened in 1988.
He was 20 at the time.
Okay. 20 at the time.
So I went in 70, and they didn't know how to give a Stanford-Binet off the ship.
That's why I'm saying courts know this too, and it's going to be difficult to try to say somebody qualifies under Atkins if all you've got is one IQ test you took at TDC. It's going to be virtually impossible to get a court to grant any type of relief under Atkins, if that's all you've got.
I have two things to report. I've been informed by, Gloria just came back on the air, and this clock does not work. If somebody can fix this clock, I would appreciate it. So I know what time it is. And, Gloria, is that you?
Oh, yes, sorry. Witnesses and media have come out, so the execution's over. Galen Bradford is dead, and Texas has begun the summer on a note of death with about, 8 more scheduled for the summer.
Yeah, we've got 4 this month, right?
Yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks. On the 15th and 16th, there's executions, and then one more in June. I think there's 3 in July, and 2 or 3 in August. Good God.
Gloria, normally the process takes about 20 minutes. This took about 29 minutes.
Right. I don't know what happened yet.
Yeah.
I guess
we'll find out in Grazik's story from Associated Press in the morning.
Right. Grazik was the first one out. I'm going to try and talk to his Swiss friend. I still haven't seen her. I know she's going to hook up with the gentleman that witnessed.
Okay.
And then they'll be going to Dallas. The funeral will be in a few days in Dallas. His daughter was concerned about his property. She wanted his radio, so I gather she's probably a teenager.
Yeah.
But neither the daughter or any of the family members could be here for the execution.
Okay, Gloria, give my regards to the vigilance there. And
okay, I just got a call from Austin. There's 15 or 20 people at the Capitol.
Oh, good. Good.
And they wanted to know what was happening also. So
okay, who organizes in Austin?
I don't know. I think it's the Texas Moratorium Network and the Campaign to End the Death Penalty.
And some student groups up there, too.
Well, the Campaign to End the Death Penalty is based...
is a student group.
At UT, so it's a lot of students in that. But I talked to Scott Cobb, and Lily Hughes just texted me, so... I know those two groups are there, the Moratorium Network and CEDP. And this Monday in Denton, the CEDP in Denton is, I guess, at North Texas State or whatever it's called now, is organizing a rally called Innocence Matters. And it's going to be focusing on Troy Davis in Georgia and Rob Will here in Texas. And I'm one of the speakers.
Okay, Gloria, keep us informed of that, and we'll probably see you in and around the prison show.
Okie doke. All right.
You. That's
bye-bye.
Gloria Ruback, and Gloria is an organizer and the founder of the abolition movement, and you can find out about that from abolitionmovement.org. And now we have our every one when we do this, Elizabeth tries to find us someone who will give us a different perspective on the issue. And today's special guest is Hooman Hadayati. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, Hooman, you're on the air, please.
Thanks for having me here. Just to mention something very fast, I'm actually at the Austin Vigil in front of the Capitol. And just to give you some updates, there's about 20 of us here, about 10 local activists who usually come at this vigil during execution days. And since a month ago, the Plum Blossom Buddhist organization in Austin has been participating in execution vigils, and they have about 10 members present who are meditating in front of the Capitol.
And how did you get involved in the execution issue?
I've been involved as a student when I was in UT, but currently I work with an organization called Witness to Innocence, with the Texas chapter of Witness to Innocence, and we're a national group that works with exonerated death row survivors who have spent years on death row and later were found to be innocent. So currently in Texas, we're trying to create a community of exonerees and their family members that will get together and, speak and tell their stories, and also pressure the legislature to implement some reforms that we support.
And anything happened in this last session of the legislature, good or bad?
There were several bills that got passed. It was a mixed result. There was a bill, Senate Bill 377, that actually expanded the death penalty by making murder of a child who is less than 10 years old a capital offense. This was an expansion bill that got passed and is waiting for governor's signature, and there were about 40 House reps who voted against this bill. But there were some basic reform bills that was recommended as part of the Tim Cole Commission that did get passed. One of them requires police departments to adopt written guidelines in order to conduct eyewitness identifications. Currently, the way it works in the state of Texas is that each police department has its own guideline, and there's no set of standards that they have to follow. So this bill will require each police department to adopt a standard that they will use in their eyewitness identification. And eyewitness identification is the main cause of wrongful convictions in the state of Texas. So hopefully this will help to prevent some wrongful convictions. There was another bill that got passed in which gives more and smoother access to post-conviction DNA testing, which should help a lot of inmates who have DNA testing claim or are trying to get their new DNA evidence tested. And last few days of the legislature, they passed another bill which was specifically regarding Anthony Graves, who was denied compensation by the state of, by the comptroller's office, because the judge that issued his release order did not specifically include the word innocence in their order. So this bill puts new standards which they have to follow, and as long as the state attorney in affidavit says that he or she believes the defendant is innocent of the crime in which he was convicted earlier on, they should be able to issue compensation for them.
Well, you know, I was just visiting with my friend Clarence Brantley a couple of weeks ago. And Clarence's case is very important to we at KPFT because Ozell, his brother, came to us. He dressed up to come do a radio show and wanted to tell us about his innocent brother, and I just kind of didn't pay much attention to that until he got to the point of saying that the prosecutor and the judge went into the bathroom and flushed the evidence down the toilet. That got my attention, and I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, well, the court reporter was there. And so the next week we had the court reporter on the show, and sure enough, that opened up a case. Clarence now has been out, 15 years. And he is yet to receive any compensation because the order issued by the court, the judge of which is now was the prosecutor when he was convicted, has now got the same guy as the judge of the court where he was convicted. And the prosecutor in the county where he is convicted wrote the order that said that he was under no more jeopardy. If that's the deal, how can we expect that order to be written in such a way as that anybody will ever get any compensation?
I mean, that remains to be seen. Clarence did apply for compensation, and 2 weeks ago, again, in a similar case as Anthony Graves, comptroller's office denied his compensation on two grounds. One was the one that you mentioned, the actual innocence claim, that it was not included in his release order. And they also say that he should have filed for compensation within 3 years, which he filed too late.
Sure.
So we did have a press conference.
We can hold you for a dozen years, but then you've got a deadline to file for some chump change compensation for being wrongly convicted.
Yeah. So what Clarence, I believe, has to do now is, you know, he has to, I mean, get an attorney and sue the state in order to be able to get his compensation. That's what Anthony Graves' attorneys were doing. And we did actually have Witness to Innocence help to organize at the Shape Center, a press conference.
I was there.
You were there, yes.
Yeah, I was there.
So we started a campaign in which to seek justice for Clarence Brantley. And his case is one of the cases that exactly shows what's wrong with the death penalty in Texas. Everything from racism in bad legal representation was involved in his case. And as you mentioned, mysteriously, all the evidence in his case disappeared. By the DA. They came back and they said, we don't have any of the evidence that would have easily exonerated him. So so there are strong grounds that he can sue the state in order to be able to get his compensation, or the legislature might need to come back again next year. There's no more time left this year. I mean, in 2 years, and have another bill that...
And there's another problem, and that is Clarence is not a spring chicken. Clarence and I are approximately the same age, and he's going to run out of time before anybody writes him a check. And that is a great travesty. I don't think that those kind of damages accrue to subsequent generations. I think that when Clarence dies, the case is moot. It's kind of like nautical law.
Yeah.
And this is an open sore tragedy. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate any effort that you folks can do with this. There's a book called Clarence Case is called White Lie by British Journalists, and I look forward to the movie because movies seem to get results.
Yes.
At least they got the man executed tonight, Galen Bradford. There was a movie of the crime, and it works very well to execute a man. I wonder if it works very well to exonerate or compensate one.
Mm-hmm.
Hunan, is there anything else you can tell us about Witness to Innocence?
To Innocence? No. Clarence will be in Virginia in a week. Our organization has this twice a year. We do a gathering where we bring exonerates from around the country in one place. It's a peer support conference, educational event, where the exonerees get together and decide plans for our organization for the coming year. And Clarence has been very active since last year, so he's going to be playing an important role, and we will be helping him in his struggle to get the compensation that he deserves for the years he's been wrongfully convicted on death row.
Thank you, Hooman. Thank you very much for being on Execution Watch, and please keep us informed of all developments in your important work.
I will.
Thank you, sir. And that was Hooman Hadayati. And I want to thank Elizabeth, who is our producer, for tracking that wonderful person down so we could share it with us. Well, we're down here to just us, and I don't know what conclusions the rest of the table has come from, but I think somebody decided that Galen Bradford was not worth saving. And I think sometimes maybe defense lawyers or maybe the obligation of the prosecutor could have gone back and given us some more light about the level of his retardation from previous school records. I remember one time Mike Charlton had one of these cases, and I was hired as an investigator to go find school records. And you'd be amazed how difficult it is to get your hands on those records. And if you can get your hands on those records, even for a person on death row, it's a maze of explanation. But we found one telling teacher's note in all of that file, and I don't even remember the name of the defendant, but the teacher's note said, this guy does not have a chance because this society does not understand that he does not understand.
You know, that reminds me, I remember reading a biography of Sonny Liston, and one of the most graphic things I remember is that he died at the day he was born. And there are some people like that. And one thing I want to mention, I want to kick off a different discussion if I can. I don't believe in the death penalty, but not for a lot of reasons that people give. But I think one of the obligations we got of those of us who don't believe in is to be realistic about things. And I think sometimes we try, Larry Douglas was talking about some people who do heinous acts. When you talk to them, they seem rather normal. They're trying to do the same thing over again. And reminded me, I remember when Truman Capote got involved in the death penalty case up in Kansas.
It destroyed Truman.
Well, it did. And if you recall, he was talking about the difference in personality changes that were people were on death row once they no longer had that sentence hanging over them.
Sure.
That they weren't the sweet, lovable, cuddly puppy dog like they were on death row.
You know, I knew Truman Capote.
Well, go back. I want you to talk about the change in people. Once you're on death row, they can really impress people from, you know, women and all these people, how wonderful they are. But when that sentence is lifted, sometimes they're not quite as nice as they were on death row. Would you comment on that?
No, not just death row. There are people in prison.
Okay.
That, you know, the preachers come down and meet them, and they say, oh, this make a nice son-in-law. He's handsome.
Yeah.
He's obviously got good physical genes. I want to get him hooked up with Butch Ainsworth got hooked up with a preacher's daughter. And whenever he beat her up for about the fourth time, Preacher went over with his Bible in hand to talk to Butch Anger. Butch Ainsworth about how he treated the preacher's daughter, and Butch Ainsworth met him at the door with a shotgun and blew him and the Bible in half.
Susan, would you comment on that? Because you and I have talked about that a lot before. Remember the time we went up to see, I believe it was Aaron Lee, and a bunch of women were talking to people on death row cooing like sophomore sweethearts. Would you comment on that?
Well, you know, like both of you were saying, some people, when they're actually locked up, whether they're on death row or they're locked up, when they're meeting a person such as their defense lawyer or a person that they think can, shall we say, give them some benefit, and a lot of times women, okay, a lot of times they can be very charming to women. And a lot of women, I guess, get some satisfaction from that. And
no,
so,
women, and I don't think...
I'll tell you what it is. They can be in love and not have to take their clothes off.
I don't want this to sound sexist or anything, but there's something appealing to women about vulnerable men.
I tell you, it's a Daniel Steele novel.
I actually think
like
there's
a Daniel Steele novel.
Sure.
They have that excitement of seeing somebody sweet to them. They have to go home and get undressed and show their fat.
Yeah. It's the mother instinct.
I think you're right. I was going to say sort of like a little nurturing quality.
Oh, and you think you know about it. You should be here on the prison show. I mean,
I've seen it, Ray.
That's business. That's a normal, ordinary part of business. And so my friends who are psychologists and psychiatrists and all of that say, well, are you sure you want to participate in that? And I said, if it were my life, I'd have an opinion. It's kind of like an abortion. Since I don't need one, I'm not going to deny somebody else the decisions they need to make if they do.
Well, also, look, some people, the level of intelligence in your, shall we say, harm to other people does not have to... I mean, people can be extremely intelligent and extremely, shall we say, prone towards criminality or hurting other people. A person could be of very low intelligence and, you know, very kind to people. So one thing does not necessarily have anything to do with the other, so to speak.
Because there, you talked about that earlier. Would you comment on people who can be very pleasant once you get to know them? They don't seem to be so bad.
Well, on a lot of different levels. I mean, one, we're talking about the death penalty hanging over people, or just being in jail or prison hanging over people. Well, that does tend to make a person a whole lot nicer than many of them than they'd be otherwise. There's kind of a joke.
But is that a permanent nice or just...
No, not at all. I mean, the joke is, I don't know if you've heard it before, about how people go to prison or to jail and they find Jesus in jail.
That happens a lot, but Jesus don't go with them down to stop.
Tob is where they always find Jesus.
But once they get out, they can't find him. So the joke is Jesus must be in TDC. He can't get paroled because they can only find him there. But I'm talking about even people who...
Knowing the parole board, that has some credibility.
They probably wouldn't parole Jesus, would they?
but even people who don't have that punishment hanging over them. I mean, I've known people who are just repeated thieves, for instance.
Yeah.
And they'll steal from relatives and friends, and they're the nicest guy in the world.
Absolutely.
Help out. They're washing dishes and helping people cook, and they'll turn around and the next day go back and break in the same guy's house.
Tell about that game, about the guys playing game and the necklace. I think that's one.
I've had one client before. Guys who just hang around playing video games all day. These are the grown guys who've got a mother and a baby mama taking care of them, and they hang out playing video games all day long. And then after a while, sometime they even start to take advantage of each other. I mean, I had one guy who pulled a gun and robbed one of his players, one of his friends, of a necklace because he just wanted it. He said he had a nice gold chain, and I took it because I wanted it. It just makes no sense whatsoever. And that's with no pressure hanging over him, death penalty or what have you. It's just sometimes people change and to see people who seem like they're really okay people. Because I represent a lot of guys who just seem like really nice guys. But when you read through the offense report,
Larry,
and see what they've done.
I did time with them. I was in prison.
Okay.
But you were one of the nice guys.
These are the people all around me.
But you've got to watch them.
And no. Absolutely. I know convicts who would steal your wallet in a minute, would steal her purse in a minute. I handed my wallet, be gone for 3 weeks, and wouldn't be a penny missing on it. Why? Because we're the same breed, and y'all are not.
Like Seal said, he's my kind.
Right. There is honor among thieves. It's not infallible, however. But there is honor among thieves. And I don't think we have ever executed the person that did the crime. I think by the time they go to execution,
I'm with you now.
They're an entirely different animal, regardless of whether that is circumstantial, whether it's atmospheric. I don't know exactly what it is. And there are several people who go to death row because they got incredibly drunk, incredibly stoned, and nothing is in here about what kind of blood test Galen Bradford might have had if he had been given one, and how much of that behavior, that irrational behavior, was a chemical that he had consumed that affected his judgment incredibly. Because prison is full of people who got drunk and stoned and went stupid and did such horrible, nasty things that that haunts them every morning when they wake up.
But even without an intoxicant, though, Ray, you're saying that the person who, we don't execute the person who committed the crime, over the time, people are just going to change anyway.
Sure.
And I can tell you from having represented people before, you don't want to, if a person's done a heinous act, you don't want them to get to trial real fast.
No.
Okay.
The
time typically works to his advantage.
Sure.
So it's not something you want to happen immediately, but over the course of time, they're certainly going to change, whether they were under the influence or not. They're going to change.
As a matter of fact, I was talking to a warden one time, and he said what really rehabilitates people is age. And you get after a while. You get older. The prison.
That's what happened to me. I got sentenced to 106 years, and I aged very rapidly. And so 4 years, 4 months, and 17 days later, I was ripe to cut out.
It's like Willie Nelson said, after a while, the going up ain't worth coming down. After a while, you get just too damn old to do this stuff.
Absolutely. I know a bunch of guys in that situation. Grunstrom, people that are very close, and people that I love.
That's amazing. Dan is one of the most amazing guys. He spent most of his life in prison, but looks more like a banker.
Yeah.
I'd be a better convict than he would.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think he just got too old and got tired of stealing and going to jail for it.
Well, I mean, you get tired of that, and you know, I'll try something different for a while. I'll try going straight. I think that's the idea. Only we need to get to that point after a couple of years before the taxpayers have invested all that money in it.
Let me ask you this. We had that recent Supreme Court case about having to release prisoners from California.
Mm-hmm.
If they released a large number of prisoners, you think the crime rate would increase in California?
Let me tell you. I knew. I got it from a former director of the California prison system, a guy by the name of Ray Pecunier. They called him Pro Pecunier, when he came down here to take over Texas prison system after Jim Estelle. All of these people I know, all of these people I've interviewed, all these people were basically friends of mine. Pro Pecunier called me and said, "You're the guy that does that radio show on that Pacifica station?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I understand. If I come on your show, I can talk to more convicts at one time than any other vehicle that is available." And I said, "It's probably true. When can I come down?" I said, "I'll be up with a tape recorder." "No, I don't want you up here with a tape recorder. I ain't going to tape record nothing to have you slit my throat with a razor blade. I'm going to come down there and be on the air so it's live and unedited." So he come down here. And he told him that he was going to fire over half of the wardens, which he did. And he told him that he'd get rid of most of the majors, which he did. And he told him that a lot of captains are going to bite the dust. And he said it's going to create vacuums of power in prison. And some of you boys are going to die. So while we're sitting here talking, I'm the journalist. I beg, let me ask a question once in a while. And I said, "How many people in your prison do you think you could release without constituting public danger?" He said, "About 80% of them." He said, 80% of people.
Because I felt that, you know, I've heard the same thing, that they opened up all the prisons.
He said, 80% of them, 80% of the people I got in my prison would not create any kind of public danger if I cut them loose tomorrow.
So they probably got old enough, like the Dan Grunsons of the world and Ray Hills.
Those people doing big time. In the first place, the lowest recidivism rate are some of the cases where we give the biggest time.
Like murder, for example.
Murder, right. And actually, the mythology is that you can't cure a sex offender. Well, a couple of years usually does it.
Let me ask you this. Europe does castration on sex offenders. They've done that for years. What's your thoughts on that?
Europe has been practicing torture since the Catholics have been keeping records. And in the first place, it doesn't do anything about the sex drive of the person castrated. Mm-hmm. It might affect penetration, but rape is not about sex. Rape is about power.
But, you know, the evolutionary psychologists took issue with that. They claim that may be true in some. Some guys are horny. They say that's what causes it.
Now, you're talking about chemical castration, right? Chemical castration.
Because they do that a lot in Europe on chemical castration.
Oh, God.
I remember we had that big controversy with Nick Spadden when a guy voluntarily wanted to do it. Remember all that flapping?
Yeah, I remember that brouhaha. But, you know, how would you like to have your balls in Nick Spadden's hands?
Well, better his than some other people I know. Susan, you want to comment on that?
I think Nick Spadden ended up with his balls in Lee Burroughs.
Yeah, right. that Max Spadden has his own thing. As a matter of fact, I'm fixing to release a bunch of video of vice officers raiding a gentleman's club here in Houston. They're all wearing ski masks and carrying automatic weapons. And the question is how can you tell a cop from a terrorist? I mean, what do you look for? How does the people who run this club know they're not being robbed, for instance? And I'll meet with the police chief Monday, and he'll try to talk me out of that. I don't think I will be talked out of it, but film is very powerful. I do not know, and we will never know because I guess nobody's going to ask the question. What was on Galen Bradford's mind when he killed that innocent, bystanding security guard?
Brian Edward Wilson is his name.
Wilson. When he killed Brian Edward Wilson.
Williams.
When he killed Brian Edward Williams, what was on Galen's mind? Because at the heart of our legal system is the issue of culpability. Was he in his right mind? Did he have a right mind to be in? All of that accrues to culpability. And we will never get the answer to that question because it is over as of about 6:30 this evening. Galen Bradford, 42, will not breathe again. Apparently his body will be picked up. It will not be handled while it is still warm, which is all too frequently the case because they haven't been touched in years. And it will be shipped to Dallas for a relatively speedy burial with a handful of interested parties in the room. My name is Ray Hill, and I came very close to being buried in that Peckerwood Hill, that Joe Bird Cemetery in Huntsville, because when I went to prison in 1970, I was sentenced to 160 years. I believed I would die there. That did not happen. And I am out here to bear witness for those the rest of you have given up on. The rest of you have decided that Galen Bradford, 42, was enough life. I'm not sure. You have to make up your own decision about that, but the execution watch will return on June the 15th to discuss the case of John Ballantyne. You can go to our website or TDCJ's website and examine the tales. I want to thank producer Elizabeth Ann Stein. I want to thank technical director Otis McClay, without which this wouldn't happen. I want to thank the folks in the studio with me because that made it happen. And our theme music is by Victoria Panetti. She Monster International will be back the next time they kill somebody. This is Ray Hill. Thank you.